For the past few decades, American communities have been working to foster this thing called multiculturalism. We've been trying to teach each other empathy for people who aren't just like us. There's been some trial and error along the way. Novel approaches seem like good ideas for a while, then get discarded in favor of better good ideas. So here it is, 2014. As we continue to debate notions of privilege and perception, how is this experiment going? Are we more empathetic than we used to be? I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we'll be looking at changing trends in teaching about difference. That's up next on Central Standard. And yes, this is our new theme music. More about that at the end of today's show. Don't go away.
Once upon a time, not long ago, there lived a princess named Atalanta.
Welcome to 1974. This is Free to Be You and Me. It's how people used to teach cultural sensitivity.
She was so bright and so clever and could build things and fix things so wonderfully that many young men wished to marry her.
These days, educational programs bring us face to face with our own privilege. Some of us even go through a tunnel of oppression to achieve greater empathy and understanding. More about that later. Americans have tried all kinds of approaches to teaching respect across races, genders, ethnicities, and religion. For a while, we were taught to be colorblind. That's before celebrating difference. Some of us learned that America is a melting pot, only to later discover that a salad is a more apt metaphor because each ingredient retains its own flavor. But most of us still struggle to talk about difference. Why is that? That's the big question on today's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me live in the studio this morning is Kirk Peruca, president of Project Equality. Hi, Kirk.
Good morning.
You've been involved in Project Equality since 1994. That's 20 years in the business of educating people about difference. What are the major trends you've witnessed?
The major trends are that we're really seeing that diversity and inclusion is broader than it used to be. Originally, it was about race and gender. And fortunately, today, we're really looking at all of the wonderful differences that embody us.
You said wonderful differences. Is that how people have always viewed this as far as like the mentality surrounding the concept?
Tragically, no. There's a long history of exclusion, discrimination in this nation, beginning with slavery in the earliest part of the nation. So we've come a long way. There's still a long way to go. And we still see vestiges of the exclusion that has existed and still exists in the nation today.
I've heard that there have been trends that were valuing assimilation over maintaining some sense of pride in one's own differences. Can you talk about the history of assimilation?
Well, it used to be that what happened, unfortunately, was that diversity was about helping everybody to be and act white. And that's certainly not where we want to be at all. We have rich, rich cultural history. And the importance of this is to help everyone to be who we are and to celebrate who we are and to figure out ways to work effectively, because difference is really value. When we have people who think differently and have different cultural histories, we are much more effective when we're all around the table because we're included, we're valued, we're celebrated. We matter.
So would you say that the project of teaching about these things has changed?
Oh, yes.
In what ways?
Well, it used to be that we kind of said, okay, we'd like to have diversity around the table. And the reality is, who owns the table? So it's much more about being at the table, having a voice at the table, having opportunity at the table, making a difference at the table, instead of just being at the table. And the ability to impact what happens is a crucial piece. So when we have a lot of different folk around the table with vested interest in the table, we're much, much more effective. And people, there's reason to be here. There's no reason to be at the table if you're simply a placeholder. That doesn't matter. So a voice and opportunity is crucial.
Well, have we changed? I mean, the way we teach about these things have changed, but have we? I mean, have you witnessed anything you might call progress in these years?
Yeah. Oh, of course. There's definitely progress. The reality is it depends where you are. It depends what your situation is. For some, the exclusion continues to be as if it's in concrete. And so when you put in poverty, oppression, we still have a long way to go.
Dr. Susan Wilson, Vice Chancellor of Diversity at UMKC, is here with us as well. Susan is a longtime contributor and a familiar voice here on KCOR. Hi, Susan. It's great to have you back in the studio.
Hey, Jean. It's great to be back.
Well, Susan, we're all products to some degree or another of the imperfect societies that we come from and that we hope to improve. So when we try to teach each other to be better and more inclusive, things progress and we realize that our efforts require a little revision. Is that why we're always doing so much course correction?
Well, I just think, you know, I've been involved in diversity work since the early 90s, if not before. And I just think, like everything else, you know, diversity education has gone through various phases according to where we are in history.
How would you identify some of those phases?
Well, I think, as Kirk said, you know, originally some of the training was about prejudice reduction. And it was a kind of an in-your-face encounter training that was very prevalent in the 70s, where if we can just shake people up and get them to thinking.
How are people shaking each other up? I didn't experience this.
Well, back then there was a lot of kind of encounter type training where people might, in the training program, get in other people's face about their prejudices. But I think, you know, clearly we found out that kind of method really doesn't work and, in fact, created some what I would call casualties and had the opposite effect.
How would you describe the casualties?
Well, I just mean that people walked away from the training not feeling better about diversity, but feeling worse about diversity. I think the literature in diversity is very clear that there hasn't been a lot of research done on what works and what doesn't work. And I think we went through a phase of, you know, train the trainer, so we'll train other people and organizations. We just went through many different phases. I think right now we're in a good place because businesses and universities have recognized that there might be a variety of methods, but the most important thing is, if you're going to run a business, if you're going to have a successful university, diversity has to be part of your strategic business plan. Because, for example, if you're Coca-Cola and you want to sell Coke in China, you're going to have to market that very differently than if you're in the Ukraine or in the United States. So this basic understanding of cultural differences is key to your business success.
So powerful entities are starting to recognize that they have something to gain from diversity.
Absolutely. It's not just the social justice rationale, which was so prevalent for years. We should do it because it's the right thing to do, because it's morally correct. I think that's good, but that was not convincing to many people. And so now I think there's a stronger, unfortunately, sadly, there's a business driver for this. And so I guess I'm one of the people who say, we'll take it however it comes, as long as it creates progress.
Well, Susan, how did you first learn to think about issues of race and difference in your own life?
Well, I mean, that started at a very young age. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which has a plethora of ethnic communities, from Jewish to Italian. In my own family, there was a lot of diversity. My grandfather was half Creek Indian. My father was black and spoke fluent Yiddish. And my mother was Italian. And so I was plunged very early on into the world of diversity, and from there just constantly had a lot of curiosity about differences and how we make them work and how they may not work.
Did anyone teach you lessons, like actively attempt to teach you a lesson about diversity that you either found very valuable or had to work to reject?
Well, I do think growing up in all black communities, there was a message that, you know, you can't really trust white people that much, that you have to watch yourself, that you have to be three times as good just to be equal to a mediocre white person. Those are some of the lessons that you learn when you're African American, I think, growing up in communities. But then again, you know, I had a father who said, you can do whatever you want to. You know, just put your mind to it, get an education. So
do you think that maybe in hearing somewhat contradictory messages, you used critical thinking to sort that out? Or how did you teach yourself the lessons you wanted to take?
Well, I think if you're African American, you're always navigating multiple realities, because in some space, all of those things are true. In some space, all of those things have been true. And so, and at the same time, there's black people you can't trust. I mean, you know, so.
Yeah, trust maybe knows no race or ethnicity.
I think that, you know, as a psychologist, there's all kind of theories on identity development. And I think if you're different, you grow up at first thinking that aspiring to be white is the ideal, and then you go through some self-searching and figure out, you know, just like the 70s where the black is beautiful, the Chicano movement where you learn to appreciate who you are. And then lastly, you arrive at a stage that's kind of universal where people are people and you judge people on their character and not the color of their skin.
You mentioned earlier that there hasn't been a lot of research on what works as far as sort of cultivating a real sensitivity and empathy and respect across difference. Why do you think that is, and how do we develop new ideas in the absence of that kind of research?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. One is that diversity training across the board is not the same everywhere. There's no, like, international model for how you do it, which could serve as a control in a research sense for what makes sense. I mean, there's all kinds of issues about there's research that shows if you can put people together of a similar class in proximity to each other, that you can have some prejudice reduction there, but not so much if people are very different from each other and also racially different. But I just think that diversity training research is hard to do because you not only have the variables of race, gender, and all the diversities we've talked about, but different models and different people. And so, you know, I think there are some researchers now trying to attempt that, but the studies are few and far between.
In your experience, do most people want to learn, or are there people who are resistant to learning?
Well, there's always people who are resistant, but the resistance has changed through the years. Early on, the resistance was, I don't want to hear this social justice crap in some people, you know. And now the resistance is different because everybody views themselves as, you know, I'm enlightened, I'm not prejudiced, I'm not a racist, and so why do I need this kind of training, or I don't need it as much as the next person? One of the theories recently that's become tremendously helpful in this regard are a 30-year cognitive research initiative around unconscious bias. And the theory there is no matter who you are, no matter what color, we all grow up and have unconscious biases that do affect our professional judgment at work, the decisions that we make, and the way that we interact daily. And so I think that that's been a more approachable way to help people get motivated to think about their own biases.
And Kirk, have you had the experience of working with people to recognize their own biases? We talked a little bit about people growing up in minority communities and how they think about their own difference. But what about people who are, say, white people trying to learn what another person is experiencing more fully?
Well, we see that quite a bit, that people honestly aren't aware of their unconscious bias, and they're not really willing to confront it. I think it takes a really special kind of person to honestly acknowledge that, you know, I have an issue and I need to work on it. And most people say, as Susan just said, oh, I'm all good. I understand. I'm just where I need to be. But people, honestly, in 2014, we don't have as much interaction as I would like to see. I think we still lead pretty much parallel lives in a lot of ways. The workplaces where we have the most interaction, and universities and schools. But frankly, we still have a long way to go. And as Susan said a minute ago, if you really don't have connections with people, it's hard to really understand who people are and their experience.
It seems like a little bit of a catch-22, where the kind of understanding and cooperation required to bring people together in one community instead of parallel separate communities, that those would only be improved by having the mindset be different and vice versa, that one begets the other. How do you break out of that cycle of people being separate and separateness reinforcing prejudice?
Well, you know, we have to keep in mind, you know, when Tanner Colby was here in Kansas City, he talked about how even the housing patterns in Kansas City historically have led people to grow up not knowing each other, not having the same friends, the same contacts. And so growing up, I think, in a semi-segregated world, I mean, even today, neighborhoods are still fairly non-diverse except for a few. And I don't know. I think it takes effort. I think it takes a real effort, a real interest, a real willingness. But then on both sides, because I'm a believer that all people need diversity training, not just people in the majority. But I think on all sides, a real willingness to do the work it takes to get to know each other and be willing to confront your own biases.
A lot of the conversation you hear these days has to do with language, about knowing the sort of current accepted terminology and the most sensitive way of even talking about or to another person. But is not having the language the same as not being sensitive? And is having the language the same as being sensitive?
Well, I always say people will forgive errors of the head. You know, so if you just don't have the proper language, people can forgive that. But what they can't forgive are errors of the heart, where, you know, your heart is not there, you're being disingenuous, you really could care less, and you're just going through some motions. So, you know, I think these days, even though people make mistakes in how they say things, people are willing to forgive that if your heart is in the right place.
Central Standard is going to take a short break. When we get back, we'll hear about a current program on college campuses. It's called The Tunnel of Oppression, and it uses exposure to the cruelty of discrimination to teach empathy. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Today's discussion is about ongoing efforts to teach each other sensitivity and respect around difference. I've been speaking with UMKC Vice Chancellor of Diversity, Dr. Susan Wilson, and Kirk Peruka, President of Project Equality. Now let's turn to Precious Porras at KU's Office of Multicultural Affairs. Good morning, Precious.
Good morning.
So KU is one of many college campuses around the nation that uses a program called the Tunnel of Oppression as a teaching tool. And I've got to say, the name alone sounds kind of terrifying. Can you explain this concept?
Yes, the Tunnel of Oppression is a program that's existed since 1993. It started at Western Illinois, based on the Museum of Tolerance, which was in California, as a way to highlight concepts of privilege, oppression, and power for students who might not be exposed or aware of these issues. It's an opportunity to educate and encourage action on issues of oppression.
How does it work? Say I am a new student and I've decided to go through this program. What do I experience?
The tunnel that we host at our institution allows students about a 30-minute opportunity to explore various types of oppression through skits, audio, music. We have a whole gallery which has posters and readings. It's an opportunity for students to see things that they might not realize are oppression. Students spend about 30 minutes going through this activity and then at the end have an opportunity to discuss the impact on themselves, but also think about how to move it forward and what to do with the information they've just received.
What's an example of something that a person may not have realized was oppression, but upon going through this tunnel, they view something and recognize, yes, this is a scenario that depicts oppression?
I think earlier we talked a little bit about language, and so I think sometimes students don't think about the use of language, so they might hear a roommate say, that's so gay or that's retarded, and those words can be offensive to various populations, and so recognizing that use of language could be a form of oppression. It doesn't always have to be something large like murder, genocide, or physical abuse. It can be the language that you're using.
I've looked at videos from different tunnels of oppression at different universities, and they're not all the same. Some of them have actors yelling hateful slurs at students as they're passing through and acting out really extreme kinds of scenarios, but not all of them do that. What are some of the scenes you've chosen to include in KU's Tunnel of Oppression?
Our tunnel focuses on various types of the isms, so racism, homophobia, classism, etc. And so we do have a domestic violence skit because we think that that happens frequently amongst the college student population. So we do have two actors who act out a domestic violence skit. We have examples of body image for men and women because we often don't think that men suffer from body image issues, but students experience body image from the male and female standpoint. And then we really try to focus on what's happening most up to date in that what students would be familiar with. So, for example, we have a Facebook post, and we actually have a Twitter read, and students can sort of see words that we've selected to follow, hashtags that we follow around hate phrases that are used on Twitter.
That's really interesting. You know, something that occurs to me is that a lot of the language around this program is about showing students that there's something more than their own limited experience. But it could come across that what you see, the more that you experience, is just the negative of being part of some other culture. How do you deal with, I don't know, showing the positive of being part of one of these oppressed groups as well?
So the tunnel can be used in different ways, and we actually don't use it to highlight the positive experiences of various identities. It is a tunnel of oppression, and so we aim to educate students about the oppression that occurs within communities. Some tunnels do end with sort of a light at the end of the tunnel that's more positive and allow students to sort of release some of the things that they've gone through, but we don't want students to do that. We want them to connect with emotionally and academically the experience that they've just gone through. So we actually don't highlight any positives, but we do allow them an opportunity to say, what are we going to do with this information moving forward?
What do they say? Do you talk to the students about that?
Yes. So at the end of each tour that students go through, they go through about a 15 to 20 minute debrief in which they talk about what they've just experienced. One, we don't want to trigger any students, so some of the things that they experience can be really hurtful, or they might resemble experiences that they've gone through themselves. So we want to make sure that we aren't doing any damage. So we do talk about how are you feeling emotionally, what did you see, how do you experience it. But then we really move the conversation towards these things happen on a daily basis. What power do you have? Yes.
Can I jump in real quick? Because you talked about that people might have experiences that are triggered by this experience, by going through this tunnel of oppression, which is supposed to help them and move things forward. How do you prepare students? Do you use trigger warnings? And can you explain that concept?
Absolutely. Before each group goes through the tunnel, they are read a script on these are things that you might experience in the tunnel. We want you to be prepared that this might trigger you. And each tour group also has an exit guide. So if at any time a student needs to exit, there's someone who can take them through the experience directly to someone to have that conversation and debrief.
And so you talked about moving the conversation forward. How do you do that?
We allow students the opportunity to create their own sort of next steps because everybody is coming in at a different place. Some students have already had this conversation and are ready to, go out and protest. And some students are like, I've never talked about this before. I don't know what my next step might be. So we give them a list of resources on campus and in the community, and we allow them to think about what is the next step for me personally. So for that student who's never had this conversation before, it might be coming to additional multicultural affairs programs, having a conversation, meeting with some of our staff to have one-on-one consultation and conversation. I mean, for the students who are already having these conversations, it's creating their own programs or asking what they want to do in their community to make change.
So you've been doing this for about 8 years, is that right?
I've been doing this program for 9 years, and it was in existence before I came on board as well. So I think we have a history of about 10 to 12 years with this program.
And have you had an encounter with a student that really impressed upon you some value of this? I mean, can you recount any specific experience with a particular student?
I mean, I think in my time doing this program, a lot of the feedback is always that it's an incredibly powerful experience for most students who go through. I can't think of an individual student that sort of stuck with me, but I can, in my mind, see all of the responses on our evaluation forms. And most of the time, students are impacted to create their own self-awareness or advance their own self-awareness. And really, we think that that's key to education, is if we can get students to spark an interest and then continue that interest, continue to feed it, which we do through additional programs, and we have a follow-up program just for Tunnel, then we think students can start to create change.
So what do you think are some of the biggest pitfalls that people fall into when they're trying to have these kinds of conversations? You have so much experience talking with students who have been through this tunnel of oppression about their ideas surrounding all kinds of difference. What are the obstacles to having good, productive conversations?
I think number one is, and you all talked about this earlier, is getting everybody into the same space. Oftentimes, we don't come together to have conversations around diversity or social justice because it feels uncomfortable. So, one, bringing everybody to the table, but two, getting uncomfortable or getting comfortable with being uncomfortable is really key. These issues have longstanding historical, systemic foundation, and oftentimes it doesn't feel good to talk about it, but until we talk about it, we can't change it. So getting in the same space, being ready to have the hard conversation, and lastly, allowing space for mistakes. Oftentimes we think we don't want to insult anybody, and we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. That happens in doing this work. You have to just recognize that we're coming together to try and create change. Mistakes will happen, and that's okay if you move forward. Like Susan said, you know, people will forgive you for mistakes of the heart, of the head.
Susan, I do want to follow up with you on this idea of becoming comfortable with being uncomfortable. Do you think that that's an important part of moving forward?
That's absolutely important, because one of the things that makes it hard to talk about difference in America now is that people don't want to be uncomfortable. They want to feel good about who they are, and they don't want anyone to bring up things that that make them feel uncomfortable. But if you're going to do diversity work, learning how to be uncomfortable is important. The other thing I would say, this program really works, I think, on some of the beginning stages of diversity awareness. Then what I like to see are programs that then build skills and abilities, because I think in many instances, once people feel uncomfortable, they haven't often built the skills that are necessary to interact effectively in a multicultural business or university environment.
What and kinds of skills?
Well, just for example, how do I, if I come from Johnson County and have never grown up around that many people of color, what kinds of skills do I need to interact effectively, to communicate effectively in that sphere? Something very basic like that. But, you know, it's also more and more in diversity training, it's discipline specific. So that if I'm a psychologist, I'll use my discipline. I need to, in order to be culturally competent, I need to understand what psychological assessments are normed on a broad population, as opposed to giving a patient a test that really is not going to be representative and therefore give an erroneous result. So there's all kinds of wrinkles here.
So you need to not just understand the problem, but also understand your own ability to sort of work through that problem.
Well, you have to have knowledge, skills, and abilities in the realm of diversity that you're trying to operate.
We've been using a program, an approach called cultural proficiency. And cultural proficiency is an inside-out approach. So we need to know who we are, how we show up, and how then we interact. And I think that's very, very helpful. The other piece is that I think it's important to have conversation around the level of the relationship. So if Susan and I had just met, we're not going to do a deep dive into racial understanding and history. But as our relationship develops, as we develop more trust, then we can have deeper, more meaningful, more significant conversations. And too often people jump into this with no trust, no relationship, and then wonder why things go badly.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, when you talk about an inside-out approach, how do you help people recognize that first step, where they are coming from? I've heard about a program called Unpacking Your Backpack. Is that something you're familiar
Very
with?
Very similar. What I happen to be a middle-aged, middle-class, white male. And so when I show up any place when we have a diverse community, I need to make sure that my approach is one that builds trust, that builds understanding, that shows that I'm an ally. So in effect, I spend a lot of time listening and learning and supporting before I come in and say, this is what I think. Because too often, folks that look like me and sound like me have come in and said, I've got the answer. You need to listen to me. And unfortunately, that breaks community. That breaks the relationship.
And the other piece of that is just what you were saying, understanding what your frame is and how what I would call your cognitive errors cause you to not value certain people because, you know, you're used to seeing, oh, a talk show host be a certain way, or you're used to certain cultural beliefs being a certain way. And so if they don't mesh with yours, it's very easy to then make a judgment call. And I think part of what good diversity training helps you do is suspend that judgment and value that person for who what he or she brings to the table.
What should be the relationship between when people are learning about not just their own difference, but maybe their own historic privilege? What should be the relationship between that and possibly remorse or guilt or things like that, that you so often hear people associating with coming to terms with those things?
My sense is, honestly, guilt doesn't work. I don't find that guilting people moves people to a better state.
But, or shaming and blaming people.
Yeah, exactly. But if we can say, look, here's some of the historic reality. What can you do to be an ally with the privilege that you have, with the access that you have? How do you use what you've got to make sure that we have a table that is inclusive, that's diverse, that's participatory?
Because one of the problems of being in a majority group is if you sit by and allow certain things to happen and don't say anything, then you're kind of colluding with the oppression. And so one thing that's very helpful, I think, in trainings that I've been to is teaching people that when they're in the majority, their responsibility in interrupting situations that aren't fair.
So in being kind of in using power to represent people who may not have as much as they do.
And if you're really good as a leader in an organization, especially when you're white, you really want to make sure that you get folks in the room that don't look like you, that don't have the same cultural heritage, that don't think exactly like you. Because if you're really working to be effective, most of the world doesn't look like me, white male. It's a diverse community, it's a diverse world, and we're much, much better off when we have folks in the room participating, engaging, making the difference.
One kind of threshold that I think we might be kind of embarking upon is one where people are bringing not just issues of gender, but gender identity and mm-hmm. sexual orientation really into this kind of conversation. Do you think that those conversations present new and unique challenges, or do you think that it's a similar conversation to the one we've been having, just including more kinds of difference, more nuance?
Well, I do think that we have evolved into a broadened sense of what diversity means. And I think many of the dynamics are similar. And I think that most of the skills that you learn and abilities that you learn about diversity can help you in any of those conversations. The point is, everybody comes with their own set of baggage around diversity. For some, it's race. For some, it's gender identity. But the principles remain the same.
Well, we've been talking to Susan Wilson and Kirk Peruca. We're going to say goodbye now to Precious Porras from KU's Office of Multicultural Affairs. Thanks so much, Precious.
Thank you.
When we get back, we'll be discussing the talk parents have with their kids, not about sex, but about race and difference. How did your parents talk to you about these things? Would you do it the same way? Call us at 816-235-2888. Let's switch gears. We're ready for your calls. How did your parents talk to you about difference, and would you do it the same way? Call 816-235-2888. That number again is 816-235-2888. When you call, you'll be speaking with Susan Wilson and Kirk Peruca. Susan is UMKC's Vice Chancellor of Diversity, and Kirk is President of Project Equality. We're also joined by one of Kirk's congregants at Covenant Presbyterian Church, Chandra McDonald. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great.
How's everyone?
Very good. So let's talk a little bit around this table about this concept of the talk, not being the one that we're used to about the birds and the bees, but a talk about race. Susan, you were talking just over the break, and I'd love for you to just share with our listeners what you were saying.
Well, I was saying that it's a difficult dilemma, I think, for mothers of color, and particularly African-American mothers. They want their children to think that the world is a good place, that people are essentially good. But at the same time, they have to teach their sons that and daughters that not all white people are going to like you. You have to be, you know, twice as good to just be viewed as mediocre.
What is important to
that? And you really have to watch the police because, you know, you could get killed.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was going to ask is why is it important to go into situations with that understanding before they even happen?
Because they will happen at some point. They will happen, and you don't want your child to be caught off guard. You want to kind of inoculate them, if you will, against the kind of pain or suffering or bewilderment that they might feel. And I think black mothers have been doing that for years and years.
Susan, how did you have that conversation with your own children?
Well, a lot of times it would be the teachable moment. It would be the time in the park, at the ocean, where a white girl told my daughter, "I don't want to play with you because you're black," and the conversation that ensued from there. So a lot of times there are teachable moments that actually come up. There was a time in a park where some people were watching the playground and said, "Oh, what nice little nigger children," and explaining to my kids why they were saying that. But sometimes in today's society, those obvious things don't happen, but you just know that they might. And so you still want to have those conversations.
Chandra, what about you? What has been your experience with this talk?
My experience has been that I guess we have all different opinions, and especially with TV and how the kids watch that, there's different situations that can occur. One example would be when my son was watching something that had to do with the police, and they were pretty much profiling on the show. And a couple of months later, I was pulled over myself, and my son burst into tears. He was like, "Please don't take my mom to jail." So they're really impressionable at that age.
Yeah.
And it's important for us to explain to them that there's differences with everyone, and to teach them self-worth, that they're important and that they're special.
How do you teach the positive about, how do you teach that this is something to be proud of, who you are, that who you are is valuable and wonderful, while also teaching that not everyone is going to see it that way? I mean, how do you give someone a really positive sense of their own identity?
Well, by ensuring how they've pretty much have differences, but those differences are unique. For example, my daughter, she's really good at basketball, and she feels like she's the best. I instill, "You're the best at basketball." And my son's an artist. "You're the best at art." And just pretty much reassuring them that they're good at what they do.
I think, too, a lot of these conversations come up about hair and skin color. And so at a very young age, telling your child, "Oh, what beautiful brown skin you have, what beautiful curly hair." And there will be a point where they come and say, "Why can't my hair be straight like Jane's?" And, you know, explaining that because your hair is beautiful the way that it is. And those are some of the kinds of things, and exposing them to images that are positive are all the kinds of ways I think you build that inherent self-worth. But it starts young.
When I was a kid, there was some, I guess, a little bit of discussion in the Jewish community about how to talk to your kids about that the Holocaust happened, which I think it might be surprising for a lot of people that people are having those conversations with really little kids. But I've come to understand that a lot of the thought behind that is that you want to make sure that someone who identifies as Jewish is hearing that story from someone who's presenting the story in a safe way and with some sensitivity to how that person might hear it. But how do you preempt the conversation without having it maybe just too young, as a conversation about something that could be scary or intimidating?
I think when children are young, like I said, when very young, you wait for the teachable moment. Unless some incident happens, there are all kinds of teachable moments. You know, I think when they get a little older and they're going to be out and about in the world, independent from you more, that's when you really want to make sure they go in equipped with things that could happen.
Kirk, what do you think about teaching children who are white or who have some other form of privilege about race? When do you talk to those children?
Well, I think it's important to talk to the kids early, again, and to talk about celebrating differences. That, you know, we may happen to be white, but we have many, many friends that have different color, different skin tone, different history, and to really say we're all the same from a theological perspective. You know, we're all created in God's image, and that's important. That you are not special as a white person, but you're a part of this multicultural creation that is fabulous.
And exposing kids early on to a variety of different kids, so that those conversations will come up naturally.
And I think that's a challenge because, as we talked about earlier, Kansas City is a very segregated city. And I think parents need to be intentional about making sure that their kids have opportunities to interact with kids who are different. And I think that needs to happen early. And my hope is that for people who are listening to think about, okay, how can I intentionally be involved in different parts of the community, join different scout troops, different ways to react, different congregations, so that there really is the richness that we have and not just the simple segregation that has existed so long in this community.
It seems like part of the challenge is that on the one hand, we want people to have empathy, which means that on some basic level, we understand that we're all human and the same, but that we also want people to acknowledge ways in which our experiences have been different and our backgrounds have been different, and we might be perceived differently. Are those two messages, how do you make those messages compatible?
Well, you know, Frantz Fanon, who was a writer, talked about this double consciousness, this mask that people of color wear, which hopefully has become lessened in years. But you learn to live with a double consciousness, with the fact that you are who you are and you value that, and you value that in your children. But you also know the world is not always fair, and that you will have experiences even now today in 2014 that are less than desirable. And so it's balancing that double consciousness. It's tricky because, as I explained to some people who are very well-meaning, that if you're African-American and something happens that seems unfair or prejudiced, you always have to ask yourself, is that because I'm black or this person is just a jerk? And that's mm-hmm. a question that sometimes you have no answer for, but that's what we live every day.
Let's talk to Cynthia in Overland Park. Good morning, Cynthia.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. What can you share with us?
Well, whenever I hear stories of, that person said this to me, and I always feel, what is the second half of that story? Like, what did you say to that person? Because there's a third option about, did they say it because I'm black, or say it because they're a jerk, or because they really didn't know? Because sometimes the teachable moment is a two-way street. We have to train our children to respond to that, saying, by the way, mm-hmm. this is what that means, and this is what you're saying when you say this, and give them an opportunity to learn and grow. Because if we don't do that, we're just creating more Donald Sterlings in the world.
That is so true. I think equipping children with things that they can say when people make comments to them and really making them feel, A, much more comfortable in responding, but then when you don't say anything, your point, Cynthia, is well taken. When you don't say anything, the world kind of stays as it is. And so a lot of times people go along to get along, but it really is important to turn that into a teachable moment.
I wonder if anyone here has ever experienced something where talking to a child, either you talking to a child or someone you know, has that there's been some misunderstanding on the child's part and that things have kind of gone awry. Are there things that can go wrong in the talk?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's all based on interpretation in my experience with kids, because we all go off of what we believe, but that may not be the true story of what the person interpreted or meant for at the time they made the statement. So, yeah, I agree.
What have you seen go? What stories do you have that might tell us something about this?
I'm not sure if I have an example at this moment, but I know a lot of times at my Sunday school class, we'll have kids and they're pretty much diverse. They're pretty much all the same race and color. But there may be like light skin, dark skin, and a perception of you're better than me because you're lighter. Or like Susan said, you're better than me because your hair is straighter or longer. And it kind of gives you a moment to teach them you're special no matter who you are, and you're unique in your own way and made in God's image.
Yeah, I think with kids, I have not seen that much go awry. Kids are pretty open. They're pretty forgiving once you provide explanations. You know, I think adults, on the other hand, we've become a society that is so reactive, not just to race, but a lot of things, with the 24-hour media cycle and how that drives people's perceptions, that you see a lot more of that misunderstanding stuff, I think, among adults. And I think there just has to be a willingness to talk through that and work through that, and sometimes even a willingness to agree to disagree.
And when we've been doing work around cultural proficiency, I think it's really important to have a structured, facilitated conversation where people can say what they need to say in a safe space, with some ability to understand and forgive.
How do you provide that structure? That's a really interesting concept, that structure can provide that kind of safety.
Well, when we teach cultural proficiency, we provide the structure. When we have, when we facilitate, we make sure we have some ground rules that help people understand that we're going to listen and hear each other. You know, we have two ears and one mouth. And I think that's always important, to hear what people are saying, because tragically, sometimes we just talk. And also then sometimes when I'm facilitating, I have to say, okay, there may be a different approach. There may be a better approach to what you just said, because that really isn't very helpful. So we have to be real clear and candid.
I think the other thing is, underlying some misunderstandings can be fear. I remember I was facilitating a diversity training some years back, and there was a white male who seemed so very resistant, would not participate. And he was an engineer, and finally he said, "This is just beyond me. It's too complicated. I want a formula of how I should interact with people who are different, and you're not giving me a formula." And he said, "And plus, I'm scared. The world is changing around me. It's becoming more brown, more black. And that's not the world I grew up in, and it just frightens me." And, you know, I really applauded him for his courage and his honesty, because that's a platform upon which you can really make things happen and grow and change when you're honest.
What about this idea of a formula, too, that people do want to just grasp at a rule of conduct as opposed to some sort of internal transformation that would make conduct kind of natural?
And again, when you do the cultural proficiency inside-out approach, when we look at ourselves and think about how we are and how we interact, we can extrapolate it to people who are different from us. And if we're at all self-aware, you know, we pay attention to people's facial expressions, to their body expression, to what's going on, because we're in a conversation. And there isn't a formula to be a human being. You know, right. There's just not a formula.
That's right. And even the, you know, you'll see books who talk about, well, Mexican Americans are like this and African Americans. And what they do is deal in generalities. But for every generality, there are exceptions. And there's a lot of intra-group differences, just as they are between groups.
Well, maybe someday we'll have that conversation about intra-group differences on this show, but the time has run out on today's conversation about educating ourselves and each other about race and difference. Thanks so much to today's guests. Susan Wilson, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and experience.
Thank you.
And Kirk Peruca and Chandra McDonald, it was a pleasure having you here this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be there.
To listen back to today's conversation, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, tune in to hear about professional cuddlers in Kansas City. Does the very existence of a market for cuddling say something about our relationship with touch? Tune in for that discussion tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that brand new original theme music you hear is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. The standard's been set. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.